Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Since it opened to the public in 1978, the East Building has been recognized as one of the National Gallery of Art's most prized masterpieces. The passing of the building's architect, I.M. Pei, on May 16, 2019, invited a new look at his work and legacy. In her talk, I.M. Pei, a celebration of his life and work, given on July 7, 2019, Lorena Bradford in the Department of Accessible Programs at the National Gallery of Art situates the commission of the East Building within the context of Pei's blossoming career and shares some of the challenges Pei and his team encountered in developing their final inspired design.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. I'm really happy to have you here with us today in this talk on I.M. Pei, a celebration of his life and work. Thank you for all of you who are online as well. I'm Lorena Bradford, and I work here in the Education Division, and I develop and run accessible programs. And I'm also lucky enough to have my office situated in the East Building. Most days, if I'm not too distracted, when I come into work, I cross the atrium and check in with Alexander Calder's monumental mobile to see how it's feeling that day. I check out the pattern of shadows cast onto the walls and floors through the skylights if the sun is up high enough. And I marvel that even after 10 years, they still let me in before we're open to the public. It's quiet on those mornings, a foil to the energy and bustle as school groups, families, and visitors of all ages and nationalities arrive once we open. The East Building atrium effortlessly eases each individual into the museum and into the history of art and ideas, and it provides a space where people can gather and be connected. Those were exactly I.M. Pei's goals. Today, I'd like to explore the life and work of this architect with a narrow focus on the East Building. It felt like a timely moment to do so following his recent passing on May 16th of this year. I'll start by briefly introducing Pei's life and work and set the commission of the East Building into the trajectory of his career as it stood in the late 1960s. I'll then go over some of the many design challenges posed by the site and structure of the East Building, and we'll give an overview of Pei and his associates' working process and the stages of construction as the challenges were addressed and resolved. I would then like to take a look at the evolving reactions to the building at three points in time. In the few years before it opened, responses once it was completed, so right around 1978, which is when it was open to the public, and finally, to capture our views of the structure and his life's work as Pei's legacy becomes established in the weeks following his death. Before I get to any of that, I'd actually like to start with some thanks and acknowledgments, as this talk really builds on some of the excellent work done by colleagues here at the gallery. Susan Wertheim, who is our chief architect here, goes over the design process in her talk called A Centennial Celebration of I.M. Pei at the National Gallery of Art, which was jointly given with Perry Y. Chin on April 26, 2017. Perry Chin largely oversaw the renovations that were completed in the East Building in 2016. David Gariff, a senior lecturer in the Education Division, gave a talk on minimalism and post-minimalism on August 28, 2018, and he talks about the aesthetics of the building in context of the minimalist style and ideas. Both of those talks are available online, and if you're interested in hearing more, I heartily recommend both of them. I'd also like to thank Laura Pavona and Michelle Willens of the Gallery Archives for sharing many of the images that bring the construction and the impact of the East Building to life. If you want even more, I definitely recommend the film called A Place to Be, a biography of the East Building of the National Gallery, which was released in 1979. There's an oral history, which was an interview between I.M. Pei and Anne G. Ritchie on February 22, 1993, which is available online. And Michael Kennell's biography, I.M. Pei, Mandarin of Modernism, and Mark Wiseman's I.M. Pei, A Profile in American Architecture, both biographies about I.M. Pei were very, very helpful as well. Throughout my talk today, I'll be sharing the words of others, of people who knew and worked with Pei, critics responding to Pei, and of course, of Pei himself. So let's meet the man. Pei was born in China on April 26, 1917. He moved to the United States when he was 17 years old, and he would later remember, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, I think, "I wasn't really interested in becoming an architect. My real reason for coming here was that I loved American movies." He quickly fell into design and architecture and studied it, of course. He got degrees from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he went to graduate school at Harvard University Graduate School of Design, where he got his degree in 1946. At Harvard, he studied with Walter Gropius and Marcel Breuer, two of the leading architects and thinkers about architecture and design of the day. They were an important influence on Pei, so I'd like to briefly introduce their work and possible impact on their student. Walter Gropius, who's shown here on the left, standing over Ian Pei's desk. That's him in the picture. Gropius was born in 1883 in Berlin and came to America during the rise of the Nazi regime, and he died on July 5th in 1969 in Boston. He was hugely influential and a pioneer of modern architecture. The Bauhaus, he was a founder of the Bauhaus School, and they lasted in Germany from about 1919 to 1928. They focused on collaboration and creating a learning community. It brought together painters, sculptors, textile artists, furniture designers, craftsmen, and of course architects, and really artists of all kinds. As part of the learning process, Gropius believed that architects should have hands-on experience with building materials and techniques. As an architect himself, Gropius experimented with working with prefabricated elements that could be put together on site, and also was partial to new materials like reinforced concrete. His style emphasized geometric form, smooth surfaces, and modern materials, which we certainly find in Pei's work as well. At the core of his philosophy was that every design challenge, no matter the media, whether a graphic design, a piece of furniture, or a building, could be approached the same way. He taught his students to start with a plan or a layout to serve the purpose of a structure and to let that dictate the form. He is best known today for his ideas about education, perhaps more than his actual buildings. On the left, of this is, of course, Grope, as he was known to his students, standing with Ian Pei, and on the right, the iconic Bauhaus building in Dessau, Germany. Marcel Breuer was born in Hungary in 1902 and died on July 1st in 1981 in New York City. He was known for his involvement in the international style, which was popular during the 1920s and 30s in America and Europe. Hallmarks of that style include straight lines, light surfaces, and little to no ornamentation. They also were very partial to cantilever construction, and especially to give a sense of lightness and airiness to a building. He had worked with Gropius in Germany between 1920 and 1928, and they worked together at Harvard from 1937 to 1941. He is largely remembered today for having designed what is called the Vasily chair, which is what he's sitting in on the left. And he also designed in 1966, this is where the Met Brouwer is now housed in the slide on the right, an excellent example of cantilever architecture. Pei and Breuer and their wives would become good friends and often dined at each other's homes and vacationed together. In terms of Pei's education, the environment that Gropius and Breuer created at Harvard was a counter to the dominating emphasis on classicism and the Beaux-Arts style. Later in life, Pei would recall, "Working with Gropius and Breuer, I was able to demystify architecture so I could really learn." Pei had been teaching at Harvard for a short time and was much admired by fellow faculty and students. When he was offered a job as the new director of an architecture department within the well-established firm called Webb and Knapp in New York City. The firm was focused on real estate development, headed by William Zeckendorf, who's shown in the slide on the left, a big personality known for his shrewdness, love of cigars, wine, and Hamburg hats, for talking on the phone all the time, even in his car. It was said that he once put the president on hold to take another call. Unsubstantiated, but that's the office myth. When Zeckendorf decided to bring in a house architect, he recalls in his memoirs that it was about time the modern Medici began hiring the modern Michelangelos and Da Vincis, which may reveal as much as about how he saw himself. Once he decided to do so, though, a colleague recommended Pei out of a pool of possible candidates. When they first met, Pei entered his office to find Zeckendorf, of course, on the phone, and the developer waved at Pei to sit down, which gave the young architect the chance to look around the room and notice that all the pictures on display showed parking garages. Pei recalled, "The whole environment was seedy. It was clear we were complete opposites." Page struck Zeckendorf as a bon vivant and knowledgeable gourmet. They soon warmed to each other and developed a mutual respect based on ambition and talent on both sides. Zeckendorf would later say, "One of the finest things I ever did was draw my friend away from the halls of academe and into the world of building." The pairing is one that was possibly more auspicious than is generally thought. Pei would remember, "It wasn't the cut and dried method of making money in real estate that interested him. I have a feeling, and this is just my opinion, that he wanted to do something unusual. He always delighted in talking about ideas." And in that sharing of ideas, perhaps he found a kinship in the daring and thoughtful Pei. As a quick example of the kind of ideas they worked on together is the unbuilt Helix Tower. Zeckendorf got to thinking about apartment buildings and how it was impossible to add a room should one's family grow, and likewise, one couldn't very well reduce the size of an office or an apartment building if business got bad. Pei's solution was the Helix Tower. On the left is a photo montage, and on the right is a model. The inner rings would hold utilities, and the outer rings would be separated into wedges, which could be acquired and sold as needed. This was around 1948. Zeckendorf loved the idea and even had it patented and famously showed it off to other architects when they came to visit him. But the structure would have been difficult to impossible to actually construct, and it was never built. While remaining on good terms with Zeckendorf and even continuing to occupy the same office space for a very low rent, Pei set out to form his own firm in 1960. Pei would soon be awarded the project that launched his career, the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum, now in Boston, Massachusetts. Pei was chosen in 1964 by Jacqueline Kennedy, an event that Pei called really the beginning of our firm. Pei and John F. Kennedy had been born just 1 month apart, and Mrs. Kennedy felt a sort of kinship between the two in that both were underdogs on the verge of their greatest accomplishments. She would say of Pei, "He was so full of promise, like Jack. They were born in the same year. I decided it would be fun to take a great leap with him." She might also have been charmed by his insistence that he was, quote, completely unqualified for the commission. It was said that when she came to meet with him, he had his entire office painted white and he put out a vase of flowers. When she asked if he always had fresh flowers, he replied, perhaps with refreshing, youthful, disarming candor, "Oh no, we only got those for you." Following that meeting, in the elevator ride down to the lobby, she whispered to her sister-in-law, "I don't care if he hasn't done much. I just knew he was the one." Ultimately, she chose Pei from a field of distinguished candidates, again, and she would say, "But Pei, he loves things to be beautiful." There were a number of problems and delays before the building was opened in 1979. Setbacks included the assassination of Robert Kennedy in 1968 and Jacqueline Kennedy's remarriage, which Pei said left him without a client. The community where it was eventually sited also wasn't super happy about it and pushed back against the project as well. Pei would later say that the building had not been completed as he would have liked, and he was disappointed in the end result. He said, "It should have been one of my best and most important projects, but it was not. It's a sad story and one of the few projects that failed, in my opinion. I lost the client." Excuse me. That ultimate disappointment would come about a year after the East Building opened in 1978, but the final stages would have been playing out as Pei worked on the gallery commission. So I thought it was some interesting context. So here is a look down Pennsylvania Avenue, and I wanted to point out that this is the site, here's the West Building here, and here's the site of the East Building, this funny little plot of land. Pei was chosen to design the East Building on July 9th, just in a couple of days, 1968, which came almost at the middle of his career, not including his very extensive post-retirement work. The site had been set aside in 1939 when the gallery had been formed, when Andrew Mellon, who founded the National Gallery, asked Congress to reserve it for later use. We often think about the East Building project starting with Pei, but as Susan Wertheim discussed in her talk, John Russell Pope, architect of the West Building, had thought about this parcel of land to the east. He had even sketched up some ideas. I have to agree with Susan's conclusion that we're lucky they weren't built at the same time. We're the richer for having both. The search for an architect began in 1967. The building committee was made up of Paul Mellon, son of Andrew Mellon, founder of the gallery, Stoddard M. Stevens, a trustee, John R. Stevenson, John Hay Whitney, and J. Carter Brown, director of the gallery. J. Carter Brown, often known as Carter Brown, is a very important player in the rest of the story, and I will be talking much more about him and his role. That group of the building committee was advised by the architect Petro Bellucci. This image here shows Lessing Rosenwald to the left, an unidentifiable person in the middle with sort of turned away, John Hay Whitney, and then Stoddard Stevens all the way over to the right. Bellucci proposed a short list of architects he thought would be a good fit. They included Louis Kahn, Philip Johnson, and Kevin Roche, who were giants in the field. As the final decision was being made, Mellon, Brown, and the trustee Stoddard Stevens toured I.M. Pei's buildings. Brown would later say, "Each of Pei's buildings demonstrated his ability to solve one of our problems." Brown was particularly moved by Pei's National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. He had been awarded that project in 1961, a few years before the Presidential Library and Museum. And here it is. Perhaps. There we go. Pei was awarded this project only 10 months after setting out on his own, and he was 44 years old. He said that the function, the site, and even the kinds of interaction he had with the client required him to, quote, rinse his brain to get a fresh perspective. He had to blend busy collaborative spaces with quiet spaces to conduct research, what I think of as the gather and scatter. The building also had to be adaptable for future needs, which were not necessarily clear at the time. He was also struck by the surroundings, which he called infinite. He said there was no scale. It was totally different than his urban projects, where the space was sharply delineated and buildings were defined by other structures around them. He camped on the mesa where the building would be situated overnight to get a sense of the space and the light during the day and the night. The final structure was not ultimately built to his exact design, but the sturdy volumes of cubes and rectangular forms stands up to the mountain behind it. 9-foot-thick exterior walls left the interior relatively unencumbered so it could be modified as needed, and I understand that it is modified frequently. Brown, the ubiquitous Carter Brown, would recall, "The forms had an unerring sense of proportion and scale, monumental but user-friendly. Paul Mellon has a laconic manner he inherited from his father. He turned to me and said, 'Carter, I'm impressed.' I knew then that Pei would be it." When Pei, Brown, and Mellon met at Mellon's estate, Mellon actually took them through the formal sitting areas of the house and out into a garden where they sat at a table. Carter remembered that Pei was an easy sell. Architect and patron struck up a quick rapport. "Both are sons of emotionally detached bankers. Both are a bit reticent. The chemistry was super. They just hit it off. I.M. must have known this was the seminal moment in his career." This is a photograph on the screen from much later, when at the end of the building process, but I think it shows how well-matched the trio was and remained. Mellon had the ultimate say and who to pick Pei for the project, and the rest of the committee agreed in July 1968. And there seemed to be something gentlemanly and polished about Pei that fit the commission and the need for diplomacy as well. Fellow architect Robert Stern said of Pei, "Pei was an aristocrat." He also understood that this was a chance for Paul Mellon to shine outside of his father's shadow, so the East Building truly needed to stand alone, while still being visually and conceptually connected to the West Building. Construction began in 1971, and the East Building came at an opportune time for pay. In the early 1970s, his career had hit a little bit of a snag. He had been working on the John Hancock Building in Boston. He was awarded that commission in 1966, and huge panes of glass were falling out and giving his firm some trouble. A little scattering of laughter, but perhaps some of us remember that. The design was headed by Pei's partner, Henry Cobb. In the summer of 1972, a few of sheets of glass, which were 5 feet tall by 11 feet, five by 11 feet, the largest to ever be installed in a tower at that time, had popped out. The loss was initially written off as, quote, normal construction damage, but it got worse from there. In the winter of 1973, a storm came through and more than 60 panes were broken and hundreds more were damaged by falling shards. They had to put plywood on the lower third of the tower and the surrounding area had to be closed to pedestrians if the wind gusted over 45 miles an hour. It played out in the media in a huge way, where it took on the edge of a morality play often equated to the Tower of Babel, which is a metaphor for man's folly in trying to achieve too much. It was presented almost as payback for corporate greed and corruption. Other structural issues led to rumors that the whole building would need to be torn down, and eventually they had to replace all 10,344 of the windows. Eventually, experts would find fault in the glass and not the design, but it was a huge embarrassment when it was going on. Over time, it would become yet another Pei masterpiece and was awarded the American Institute of Architects 25-year award in 2011, which is recognizing a building that stands up to the test of time, and the East Building would actually be given the same award a little bit earlier in 2004. At the time of all the drama, Pei and his firm's reputation took a huge blow, and he was essentially blacklisted from corporate building for about 7 years. His career teetered on the brink, but the East Building and Paul Mellon would play a part in raising Pei and his firm back up. As a quick aside, our neighbors to the up the road a little bit at the Smithsonian Art Museum have this wonderful piece by an artist named Sidney R. Hutter. It's called Vase Number 65-78. It was made in 1990. Hutter was a glass blower, a young artist working in a glass blowing studio that burned down in a fire. And desperate for materials, he went and scavenged some of the glass that had fallen from the Hancock Building by the truckload. He would go on to create works like this using plate glass, having been inspired by the windfall of this free building material. He actually went and talked to the folks at the dump where the glass was being trucked. And if you remember that all of the drama with the Hancock Building was happening in 1972 and 73, this is dated 1990, so it shows you really how much mileage he got out of that. So go visit this wonderful little vase at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, Lew Center. Okay, back to the East Building. Pei faced a number of design challenges right out of the gate, not the least of which was something of a philosophical one. In the documentary film, A Place to Be, Pei says of the site, "I would say this is the last chance. There's simply no more sites left after this. This is perhaps the most sensitive site in the United States." Talking about visitors, he continued, "We've got to keep them. Once they come in, we don't want to lose them. It would be terrible to come in, look at it, say, I've seen it, and then go home. So I think the function of this space not only is to constantly orient people, but also as a place to be." In the afterword to 1978 publication, Pei elaborated publication about the building, the construction process of the East Building, Pei elaborated on the task when he wrote this. This is a little bit of a longer quote, but it gives us a lot of insight into his thought process in approaching it. "The project of the East Building of the National Gallery presented a singular challenge, as its location on the Great Mall possesses special significance to me. I was 17 when I first came to America, so I felt most seriously the national and symbolic character of my task, which I faced, therefore, with both anxiety and exhilaration. I was grateful for the opportunity this commission gave me, but I felt the burden of conceiving what must be the final physical enlargement of the National Gallery. I knew it had to have the flexibility to provide a place for varied exhibitions, and more than that, to create a welcome and exciting public space in which people could celebrate the visual arts with relaxation, stimulation, and enjoyment. But most of all, I knew it had to be designed to serve an unknown future into which we look with great hope. Early on, critics also understood the challenge of this assignment. Wolf von Eckhart, who was a reporter for the Washington Post, had a lot to say about pay over the years. And in 1968, when this was all beginning, he said this, that the commission was no doubt one of the toughest assignments since Michelangelo was asked to put a dome on St. Peter's. He could not possibly, in an age of spaceships, just copy the Beaux-Arts classic details of the old gallery. Yet the mind reels at the thought of any modern structure adjacent to Pope's luxurious museum. Some specific challenges. The East Building would need to stand its ground visually against the stately and grandiose West Building. And this is a view across the 4th Street Plaza to the short end of the West Building. So this is what faces off against the East Building. And also to other buildings in the area. Pei wanted the East Building to be of his time, so didn't want to copy that style exactly. The shape of the land was a huge challenge, and one of the biggest challenges was that the axis for this very strong east-west axis that comes from the West Building falls off-center in the plot of land across the street from it. There were also height restrictions. Constitution has lower height restrictions than Pennsylvania Avenue, but both were a challenge to design to, both to meet them and also to juggle them both. And there were also setback requirements put in place by the National Planning Commission that reduced the amount of space the building could physically take up. This ends up being the first building on the National Mall that does not have an entry/exit onto the mall. It only opens up onto 4th Street and not the mall itself. The proposed design needed to be approved by Washington's Fine Arts Commission, which approved it in a split decision 4-2 in February 1970. Pei ended up corresponding with one of the two who did not vote for the proposal, a man named William Walton. Walton wrote this to Pei. "I feel that the new building will be a harsh, overassertive terminus to the long line of buildings leading towards the Capitol, whose environs are a very touchy matter, both aesthetically and politically." To which Pei responded, "Your criticism about the excessive height of the design does not surprise me, for the problem has been a matter of great concern to us from the very beginning. The final resolution, however, is the result of a great deal of deliberation." So how did he arrive at the design? The very famous envelope sketch. After visiting the National Gallery, what is now the West Building, and taking a look at the site that would be the East Building, Pei was flying back to New York from Washington, D.C., when, in a flash of inspiration, he pulled out a scrap piece of paper, which happened to be an envelope, and sketched this on the back. He remembered this moment in the oft-quoted memory, "I was returning to New York after a gallery meeting in 1968, trying to find a solution to that difficult site. I sketched a trapezoid on the back of an envelope. I drew a diagonal line across the trapezoid and produced the two triangles." That was the beginning. Part of the brilliance of this plan is its simplicity, which seems obvious once it's put on paper. Another key feature is that it lines up the east-west axis of the West Building with the center of the large isosceles triangle and not the overall plot of land. So this is a pretty rough sketch, but it shows how this is this round circle in the middle was, Pei originally thought he might have a large circular fountain between the two buildings. But it lines up with the one of the triangles and not the pair of them. Pei had become known for being able to come up with innovative and groundbreaking solutions to problems even during and shortly after meetings. One scholar cited his Chinese colleagues as likening Pei to a master watercolorist, creating art with economy, with decisive, swift, and fresh strokes. And I cannot think of a better analogy of the envelope sketch on the left than that. There are dozens and dozens of sketches like this, which give us insight into the brainstorming process. I like to imagine Pei and his colleagues sort of working over pieces of paper like this and each contributing and thinking through these ideas. This also seems like a good moment to pause and step into Pei's working method. And he explains, he describes it a little bit when he says, "I get into a great inner turmoil when I have to find the right design for a building. It absorbs me completely and I can't think of anything else. This may be a matter of hours, or it may take as long as a month of sleeping badly, being irritable, sketching ideas, and rejecting them. I am useless to everyone else. It is traumatic to my wife. As an aside, we also know very little about Pei's relationship to his wife, Eileen, but by all accounts, they were very close and she supported him. Eileen once talked about how she would wake up in the morning to find little bits of paper all over the house with little sketches and reminders to do things and call people when Pei had been working in the middle of the night. Their adult son would call Eileen Pei's secret weapon. So, some more sketches here. More generally speaking, I think that it's also worth thinking about Pei's general approach to design. And again, this is a little bit of a longer quote, but it really gives us a lot of insight. Why use two strokes when one will do? You need to recognize and accept the constraints of a project and prioritize them so you can get to the crux of the matter. Only when this is done can you address the solution, because if you dream a solution without reference to a problem, it is just a waste of time. Design at this point is still a long way off. In other words, before you can deal with form, space, light, and movement, the things that go into architecture, you need to reduce very complicated requirements down to their essence. This is not easily accomplished. It takes time. Once you identify the key issues, you solve them one by one, always keeping the heart of the matter in clear view. Thus, the process starts out very complicated, becomes simpler, simplest, and then returns to complexity in their development and detailing of the completed building. Especially like that idea of it being complicated and then simplifying down and then becoming complicated again. Once he recognized and accepted the constraints of this project, of the East Building, the ideas certainly flowed. And the main one was the triangle as the organizing principle of the entire building. It was a tough decision for him to come to, and Carter Brown, director of the gallery at that time, remembered, Pei was nervous about it. He'd never done a triangular building before. The wide ends tend to be a horizontal space that is to read visually as a horizontal space, and the narrow end tends to be a vertical space. The visitors, therefore, are driven into a corner. IM said he couldn't sleep at night until he saw the model. IM has as near a perfect visual pitch as anyone I've met, so I didn't worry too much. It certainly made the layout of the construction very difficult, and William Mann, one of the local builders on the construction site, said this. It caused a chaotic condition among carpenters. They're used to working with tools that are made for rectangles, not triangles. So our surveyors had to lay out everything for everybody, all the electricians, the mechanical people, everything, because none of them had the expertise to lay out a triangle. Surveyors are, of course, the unsung heroes of any construction site, which I don't just say because my husband is a surveyor, but it's nice to see all kinds of different people get credit for the work that they did on this building. The triangle as an organizing principle allowed for dynamic and interesting perspectives and a truly active space. Square or rectangular spaces can certainly be visually pleasing and surprising, but are more conventional and predictable. One orients to the space very quickly when the sight lines are established. In a triangular space, one constantly reorients and new perspectives reveal themselves. Over time, Pei would separate the two triangles, which were initially sort of one up against each other, and decided to center the galleries around a large atrium. The double triangle also allowed the study center and offices to be separate. Of that, he would say, you can't just mix them all up in one building. But everyone who accessed the library, study center, including employees, students, and visiting scholars, would need to go through the part of the museum where art was displayed to have at least that fleeting engagement. Gallery spaces were refined to smaller rooms on the ground level for small installations and intimate viewing on the human scale. And spaces on the upper levels had adjustable ceiling heights to allow for large-scale works of art to be shown. Pei brought in a new young associate, William Pedersen, to work on the triangular layout and sort of see it through the design process and what it would entail. And Jan Weymouth also was heavily involved in this project. The construction process wasn't smooth. The complexity of the plan meant that problems were constantly being troubleshot. Complicated also by a jumble of utilities and water lines, which ran under 4th Street, and a very high water table, which meant that the East Building essentially needed to be constructed as a watertight vessel. Furthermore, planning consultant David Scott once quipped, "The design team was forever coming up with some bright new idea that set the whole construction back 6 months." But he was also on Pei's side, where he said, "Pei is absolutely delightful to work with. He listens intently to your problems and then firmly but graciously comes up with a solution that invariably evolves from common sense and the dignity of the building." There were also a number of worker strikes that slowed construction down. When John Russell Pope was working on the West Building, he had 21 shades of pink Tennessee marble to choose from. I will say 21 shades to the very experienced eye. By 1970, the quarry where that marble had come from had actually been closed, and the quarry master who worked on the West Building had retired. They brought him out of retirement to work on finding marble for the East Building, and they reopened the quarry. By 1970, there were only 15 instead of 21 different shades, and they kind of fell into only a few kind of easily discernible shades. They were grouped by use on the exterior and interior spaces with the walls and the floors outside and inside. On the West Building, especially outside, the marble is laid so that it's darker on the bottom and it sort of fades lighter as it goes up. You can really tell this more in the rain. Then that kept it from looking like a checkerboard with the dark piece next to a light piece. A similar effort was made with the East Building, but resources were more limited. The marble facade here is truly that. It doesn't support the weight of the building at all. So the building actually needs to support its weight. It has to float. Pei used a lot of architectural concrete for structure, and this is one of the first buildings to really use it in a significant way. The marble took 3.5 years to quarry, prepare, and place all the stone, the outside skin, the inside walls, and the floors. And the marble covers spans of up to 360 feet. And then, of course, there's the very famous knife edge, which is shown in this image on the right here. This is outside. It's 19 degrees, 28 minutes, and 16 seconds. If anyone knows what that means. The 19 degrees, it's very, very sharp, and you can walk up to it and touch it, and I definitely recommend doing that. Folks said when it was going up that there's no way that it could support itself, and they expected it to come down before it was even completed, but it remains. When it came time to start pouring the concrete, the architectural concrete, which is used all over the place, a few concessions needed to be kept in mind. In the documentary film, A Place to Be, I think my favorite moment of the whole thing is when a foreman brings a group of workers into the West Building to look at the scale model of the East Building to see what it's all going to look like when it's finished. The foreman addressed the workers and emphasized the importance of getting the construction process just right and of being patient with everyone. He concluded with a smile, "You'll just never do anything like this again in your life, and so you better live it up this time, this once around, the way I look at it." They used cabinet makers, made the coffer forms, and each mold was used just once and then discarded, so most of them are unique. When the concrete was poured, the water cooler for the workers was removed so that paper cups would not make their way into the concrete, and the workers all had to clean their shoes. The poured concrete coffer forms cured for 3 months, and I just invite us to take a moment and imagine what it would have been like for 3 months to go by, and the workers to start taking away the wooden molds, start breaking them down, breaking them away, and the sense of pride and perhaps relief that they must have felt when they finally saw how beautiful the end product had been. It's a long time to wait to see how something turned out. Creating a roof for the space was definitely a challenge. Pei had initially thought he would cover it with a concrete coffered ceiling, which is almost impossible to think of now with the way that it exists with the skylights. But at this, to get a better sense of what this would be like, they brought in artist Paul Stevenson Oles to create perspective drawings to show the overall impact of design choices really among many points along the way in the design process. Here we get a sense of the sense of heaviness and darkness that would come if we had a much extended concrete ceiling. As an aside, these sketches by Oles are some of my very favorite works of art related to the East Building. For the imagination it takes to conceptualize sometimes abstract ideas and capture them in a rendering to show what it would actually look like. Now we use computers, and I think that something really gorgeous is lost with this process. I also like that it shows the value of having so many different perspectives and expertises brought into the process. Here's someone who could really imagine, put into visual form ideas that other people had to see what the impact would be. Pei also considered using planar skylights, that is, flat skylights, but he finally came to the steel frame with the glass and aluminum tetrahedrons, the shape of which echo the footprint of the atrium below. So tetrahedrons are kind of like pyramids, and we'll often hear them called pyramids, but they're three-sided and elongated. The skylights are held up with welded steel frame that would be formed of 30 by 45 foot tetrahedrons, and it weighed a total of 500 tons. It appears weightless when we look up at it, I think, but it was 500 tons, covered 16,000 square feet. Pei called it a bunch of jackstraws thrown into the sky. The sheer size of the skylights actually makes the building feel smaller. If the windows had been small, sort of what we might think of as a normal scale, an us-size scale, it would make the space feel massive and perhaps out of scale. Here are a couple of images of the frame being put into place on the left, and then the way that it looks. If you go up onto the rooftop sculpture area, you can look down onto this system. Trees were also part of the design. The photograph on the top is from right before the opening, where we can see the empty planters, and then here they are filled up down here. Anne Ritchie, who did that oral history with Ian Pei in 1993, asked Pei if he brought Chinese traditions into his architecture, and he answered, "No, not consciously, no. You see, my technical training is all in the United States. My architecture training was completely Western. The garden, yes, bringing nature inside was very much an Eastern tradition." And then, of course, this auditorium is also part of his design. There are many other features that I will not linger on, including the plaza, which we see here that stretches between the East and the West building, the connecting link, which runs underneath it, where the cafeteria, a couple of our shops, and, of course, the moving walkway with that beautiful work by Villarreal. And these tetrahedrons here, and then this fountain, which turns into a waterfall, are all part of Pei's design. On the connecting link, Cannell, who is one of Pei's biographers, described the building and the connecting link, the underground link, as a couple holding hands under the table, which I just love, like the two buildings holding hands under the table. Pei also relates to Anne Ritchie in that oral history that he wanted the connecting link to be at least two levels to accommodate more storage, parking, and general space, which would be very welcome. But the location of the Tiber Creek, which ran underneath that area and made the high water table, meant that there wouldn't be enough weight to hold it down when it rained. So the entire East Building holds the East Building down, but you couldn't cover 4th Street, so there wasn't enough to actually keep it underground. He remembered that it would have cost about $200,000 per foot to go even deeper, so it ends up being just the one level. Each element in the East Building has a rich story, including these features and the works of art that were commissioned for the opening. But in the end, the opening had to be pushed from 1975 to 76 to 78, and the final cost was $94.4 million. Of that final price tag, Paul Mellon said, $95 million does seem like a lot of money, but after all, we're not building a resort hotel or a high-rise office building that will be torn down in 20 years. We're building a museum, something intended to last forever. Of the experience of the East Building, which I think is worth lingering on for a moment, Carter Brown reflected, "The museum, so often visited during workaday hours, must rely on its architecture to prepare us, the visitors. In the West Building, we enter into the great domed rotunda where we are surrounded by serene architecture and the sound of splashing water of the fountain. We orient ourselves as we walk through the tall sculpture halls. There is a gradual lowering of ceiling height and the size of space as we reach rooms in which works of art are displayed. The processional process over time gives us the sense that we are in a very special place and prepares us emotionally and psychologically for the experience. So we may begin our very personal dialogues with individual works of art. Brown goes on to say that the West Building represents an older Western tradition derived from ancient Rome, but things have changed in the modern age. Our world, then, is one of multiplicity and simultaneity, and our approach to it assumes not one point of reference, but many. With time a significant dimension, this is reflected with great clarity in the East Building. Its plan and its spaces are no longer orthogonal, but triangulate. Like the West Building, it provides a processional experience. If one enters the concourse level through the connecting link, the long tunnel is a contemplative preparation, invites one on into the lobby where the space explodes over one's head. When entering from the plaza and the front exterior porch, the splayed side walls of the two west towers offer welcome, and the coffered overhang high above, shelter. Through the revolving doors, one enters a low space, which is almost intimate in scale, before moving out into the light-flooded court with its soaring space frame high above. Others have likened coming into the East Building as entering a church, perhaps through an arched doorway into a low entryway, and then being swept up into the high open space beyond. I'd like to take a few minutes to think about the style of the building. Carter Brown, said, the original gallery is wonderful, referring to the West Building, but America finally has enough confidence to build in its own style. This really gets at the idea that this building has come of age at the same time that the country has truly found its identity within an international context. Ultimately, though, Pei's building is a modernist masterpiece completed in the age of postmodernism. At times, Pei called himself a second-generation modernist and saw himself as part of an ongoing legacy. He said, "Architecture is like a tree. It grows and matures and branches out. I am part of that tree, of that movement, not starting or ending or following anything." To put this in some context, let's quickly take a look at this moment in architectural history. Postmodern architecture began in the 1960s largely as a reaction against modernism and its emphasis on clean lines, little ornamentation, and a perceived coldness, and its stripped-down, austere aesthetic. Robert Venturi helped establish and codify this style with his books Learning from Las Vegas, which was written with an urban planner and his wife, Denise Scott Brown, in 1972, and Complexity and Contradiction in Architecture. In the latter, he wrote this, "I like elements which are hybrid rather than pure, compromising rather than clean, accommodating rather than excluding. I am for messy vitality over obvious unity. I prefer both and to either two, black and white, and sometimes gray, to black or white. An architecture of complexity and contradiction must embody the difficult unity of inclusion rather than the easy unity of exclusion." In other words, he and other postmodern architects preferred fragmentation, ornamentation, and complexity over simplicity and cohesion. Mies van der Rohe, another giant architect of his time, perhaps the greatest hero of modernist architecture, would famously say, "Less is more," to which Robert Venturi would respond, "Less is a bore." That pretty much sums up the differences between the two schools of thought. On the screen is the Vanna Venturi house, which constructed in 1964 for the architect's mother, and one of the earliest examples of this new style. And here are a couple other examples. Postmodernist architects criticize modernists for turning their back on architectural history. So architects like Charles Moore on the left and Michael Graves on the right revived and adapted classical forms, including capitals and columns and all kinds of other things. They also incorporated decorative flourishes, pattern, and used color in new and sometimes startling ways. On the left is the Piazza d'Italia from New Orleans in 1978, and on the right is Michael Graves' Portland building from 1982. Postmodernism hit its peak in the 1980s and lasted into the 1990s, and interviewers regularly asked Pei his thoughts about postmodernism and how his own design related to modernism and postmodernism. In a 1980 interview with Barbara Lee Diamonstein, it began with the interviewer actually quoting Pei back to himself, reminding him that he had said this, The talk about modernism versus postmodernism is unimportant. It's a side issue. An individual building, the style in which it is going to be designed and built, is not that important. The important thing, really, is the community. How does it affect life? In the interview, when pressed about whether postmodernism was ever an issue for pay, he responded, "Not really. About a year ago, this was a very hot issue among American architects. But to tell you the truth, when I travel around the world talking to architectural schools in different parts of the world, I find it is not an issue at all. I think it's a particularly American phenomenon to talk about postmodernism when we are still in the midst of a continuous development of what we know as modern architecture." I think perhaps the most convincing and useful parallel in style was drawn by David Gariff in his talk on minimalism and postminimalism. In that talk, again dated August 28, 2018, he said, "Never have things that look so simple been so complicated." He continued, "The greatest minimalist work of art at the National Gallery is the East Building itself, as a piece of architecture. Even though we don't consider I.M. Pei to be any minimalist, the East Building is a testament to the minimalist ideas and aesthetics and philosophy." David Gariff says Pei isn't much of a theorist about architecture, but he does come of age in New York City as an architect during the age of minimalism. Perhaps it appears here in the angles, pattern, repetition, and geometry. So above on the right is Donald Judd's Untitled from 1963, and below in the sculpture garden is Tony Smith's Moondog, the models from 1964, and this was fabricated in 98 to 99. Ada Louise Huxtable was a very influential architecture critic at the time, and she said, "The East Building does not break ground. It deals in established excellence." In the last chapter of our story today, I'd like to share some of the responses that the East Building has received over time, starting from the period when it was still being constructed, to the unveiling, to today, when Pei's legacy begins to be written following his death. So, reception pre-1978. Ada Louise Huxtable, that very influential architecture critic, was on board right away after seeing Pei's early model in 1971. She wrote, "The rigid rule of mediocrity through uneasy compromise with an uncertain past that has characterized the best and worst of Washington construction in our day will be broken by the new East Building. Let's go even further. It can be a great building for all time." As it was going up, critics had some things to say about it before it was even complete. Washington Post critic Wolfen Uckert, who we've mentioned before, wrote, "What had seemed so dazzlingly clever on the cardboard model grew to seemingly monstrous proportions. Had we been blinded by architect Pei's brilliant geometry? In clear light, there were moments when the huge, stark pink Tennessee marble structure seemed threatening. It seemed abstract and alien, coldly unrelated to the familiar temples along the avenue and an insult to the picturesque majesty of the Capitol in the background." A reader in the Post said it would be the ugliest building in all history. Don't worry, it gets better. Pontus Holton, the director of the Pompidou Center in Paris, which was being built at exactly the same time, said that it was too elegant. Charles Peters of Washington Monthly pronounced it the aesthetic crime of the century. And in response, Carter Brown remembers I.M. Pei saying, "It's like a teenage girl with braces on her teeth. Wait until the scaffolding comes off." That sort of sums him up so beautifully, doesn't it? Von Eckert would end up on I.M. Pei's side in 1978 when he wrote, "Yongmin Pei's East Building on the National Gallery of Art is an architectonic symphony of light and marble, color and glass, painting and sculpture. It is surely one of the most impressive statements of the art of our time." He also wrote, "My guess is that in contrast to most modern buildings, Pei's East Building, like Verdi's opera, will be instantly popular." And in another article, he said that Pei's buildings are consistently strong and decisive. Hilton Kramer of the New York Times wrote, "Entering the Great Hall of the East Wing, one is made to feel a tremendous sense of confidence in the culture and the civilization it symbolizes. It is a thrilling experience, and I suspect that it will fill the hearts of all but the stoniest skeptics with the feeling of pleasure for a long time to come." Some did find fault, however, in a few features. The glass tetrahedrons on the plaza between the East and West buildings struck some as harsh. Some wish to have more natural light in the galleries themselves, which is actually a precedent that John Russell Pope set with the West Building. When he put all those skylights on the upper level in the West Building, it was revolutionary for the time in 1941. Some felt that the pedestrian walkway was perhaps uninspired, and others thought that the triangular motif was taken to an obsessive degree without enough payoff. One critic, Christian Otto, writing for the journal Connoisseur, said, "Pei has not challenged his initial intentions. He does not use the triangular proliferation that constitutes the East Building to explore a multiplicity of forming and meaning. It is this fundamental, in this fundamental sense, the project fails architecturally." The fact that people seem to like the building seemed to bother others, including Richard Hennessy, writing for Art Forum, when he said, "The chorus of oohs and ahs which greeted this building at its opening left me completely unprepared for its shocking funhouse atmosphere, its deeply Philistine or uncultured unseriousness." The most common fault leveled at the East Building when it was first opened and still today is that there's not enough space given to art galleries and that too much is given to the atrium itself. So here we have a view of the atrium, and here's entry into one of the art galleries and into another, and there's more behind us where we're standing here. For instance, architecture critic Paul Goldberger said, "After the excitement of this space, that building has given us all, it's all, and the art itself is left to be squeezed into the corners." An important bit of background, however, behind this design choice is that the building was being designed during that process. Carter Brown had attended a conference where it was decided that visitors can take in art for 45 minutes before so-called museum fatigue set in. He came back and he estimated that a typical museum goer could cover 10,000, also quoted as 20,000 feet, in 45 minutes, and that ended up being a guiding principle behind the smaller units where art is displayed here in the East Building. Pei, Peterson, and Weymouth called them houses, and we call them pods. In that oral history with Ann Ritchie, Pei talked about the need to get art into a space designed on a human scale. He remembered that was something Carter Brown was also keen on. He said, "Carter would like to break down the scale of the big museum so that a museum of our size would not seem so overwhelming to the public. There's a limited amount of art that one can see in a day. If you show them too much, they develop museum fatigue." He went on, "First of all, you have to break down the scale of a big museum to make it intimate. The pods are supposed to do that. But also, you have to have a sense of orientation. You don't ever want to come into a big museum and feel lost. Our experience has been that, as soon as a visitor feels or wonders, 'Where am I?' they get nervous. That is bad, because that means that they would like to quickly get to where they came from. Then you lose them. They go home or cut short their visit. So therefore, to orient it, to know where you are from, where you are from time to time, you want to come back to a place you recognize. This is where I came from. That's why the central atrium was developed." He also developed the atrium as a place to, quote, come up for air so one could then continue their exploration. And that's not to say people who feel that there's too little art or that it's crammed into the corners don't have a valid perspective, but it is something that Pei addressed, and so I wanted to share it with you. Pei's death on May 16th this year naturally led to an outpouring of tributes and remembrances. Beijing-based architect Li Xiaodong reflected, "He was a true master of accommodating a complicated program with simple and clear form." Architect Santiago Calatrava is quoted in Architectural Digest saying, "His architecture confronted the modern with the classic in an iconic fashion, and through these gestures, he's elevated a generation of architectural accomplishment to rival that of past masters in a way that many of his contemporaries could not." Michael Cannell, his biographer, would say, "He did more than anyone to bring a warmed-up modernism to American cities and to make it popular and approachable." Clothing designer Vera Wang said, "His passing reminds me of the true end of an era that knew no boundaries or limitations in terms of architecture and paved the way for the buildings of today and those of tomorrow." David Ajay, architect of the Smithsonian Museum of African American History and Culture, is quoted in the New York Times saying, "He locked onto Pei quite early. I related to his very distinct trajectory as an immigrant who comes to America, makes it his home, and finds an ability to read the local landscape. He quickly understands how to make an American building. Then he translates it to other places." Calvin Tsao, a young architect working in Pei's firm before striking out on his own, recalled, "Detail was key for him. He cared about the details of the relationship with the client and of the design. I learned persistence and perseverance from him, and the power of charm, which is not easy to learn." He also shared Pei's final advice to him when he was creating his own firm. He said, "Don't get seduced by sexy projects. A good client will nurture you. Pick your client, not the project." Closer to home, Chief Architect Susan Wertheim shared, "Most of the adjectives I would use to describe I Am Pei are equally applicable to this amazing work of architecture. He was warm and welcoming. He was a practical perfectionist. He was exuberant and uplifting and full of joy. And like the building, he was timeless. Like the knife edge, he was razor sharp. This building is geometrically pure and spatially quite complex. And from it, we all learn that simplicity is complicated." One of my very favorite descriptions of the impact of Pei's building was given by Harry Cooper, senior curator of modern art here, when he said, "The atrium is the one place where things open up. There's no particular path or historical connections. It's a place where work can command big spaces and can play with each other and with us." Most of the tributes being written now focus on listing the buildings he was involved with special emphasis on the Louvre Pyramid and the controversy, and listing the awards and recognition he received, which were many. It will be interesting to see how his legacy is captured and defined in the coming months and years as an era and an age comes to an end with his passing. In a highly unofficial Facebook poll, I asked colleagues and friends to share their memories and impressions of the East Building with me. One friend described it as expansive joy. Another talked about how the light fell on, light fell like water on stone. Another said, "Somehow he made what would normally be cold and harsh into something beautiful and welcoming." And another said, "It takes you different places." All works of art are moments in time imprinted in physical form. In museums, we experience the scale, material, subject of a painting, sculpture, work on paper, textile, historic piece of furniture, but often at a distance. In a masterpiece of architecture, we move through the space and become part of the breathing life of the structure. There are very few works of art in the gallery's collection which visitors can touch anytime they wish, but I Am Pei's East Building is perhaps the most important artwork we can experience in a tactile way. Fans of Pei and those marveling at the East Building design come and touch the corners, for they may feel severe or pudgy in the palm of the hand. There are few occasions in our lives when we will encounter spaces where the walls don't come together at right angles anywhere, including the offices, which makes it very hard to fit furniture in there. The building bears traces of that honor, homage, and affection. And here's an inside tip. My two favorite angles, except for the knife edge, are in surprising places. One of them is upstairs next to the information desk, so we can all go surprise the art information volunteers. And the other is actually at the end of the moving walkway near the cafeteria and the bookstore and the restroom. That's a really good one, too. But my favorite detail of any work of art in the entire National Gallery of Art, perhaps any museum in the entire planet, is this spot, his name, which is also up next to the information desk upstairs, where visitors and employees take a moment to physically connect with this building, with everything it holds, and with everyone who has paid homage over the last four decades. I hope you'll all do the same as you explore the East Building today, hopefully with new eyes. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.